Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's Great Conversation features Michelle Carl. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. My name's Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Final Draft is dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to household names. Every week we look into the issues that drive our storytelling and help you discover more from the books you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands. And in doing so, I also want to acknowledge that these are unceded lands, stolen lands, that there has never been a treaty made with Australia's First Nations. Michelle Carl is a poet, author, and essayist. Her short story collection, Letters to Pessoa, won the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award for New Writing, and Michelle has been nominated. She has a slew of other awards and nominations. She's pretty good. Now, Michelle is joining me today with her new novel, Daisy and Wolf. In 1924, Daisy Simmons works to arrange passage from Calcutta to London. She will leave her family, her life, to be reunited with her lover Peter Walsh. But at what cost? In 2017, Mina is trying to write a novel. In it, she will restore agency and voice to Daisy, a woman who was never even given a voice in Virginia Woolf's seminal novel, Mrs. Dalloway. As Mina works to free Daisy from her fictional invisibility, she must also reconcile herself to the bonds of career, family, and duty, and make peace with the responsibility of a writer bringing life onto the page. This is a fantastic one. You might have noticed in your podcast app that this is a little bit longer than our usual episode. That is because Michelle and I had just an incredible conversation about writerly stuff and literature and what it means to engage with the canon. I really invite you to take your time and enjoy this one. And join me as we discover Michelle Carl's Daisy and Wolf. Michelle, look, it is so exciting to have you here. There is so much we've got to chat about.
Thank you, Andrew. It's so nice to be here. I'm Gurungai country, and I'd like to pay my respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. And this was land never ceded. And I stand with all Aboriginal people. So it's wonderful to be here with you today to talk about Daisy and Wolf, Andrew. Thank you.
And this is such an incredible novel. I confessed off air that there are so many threads that I want to pull on, but I'd like to give a sense of this incredible novel and take us to 1924. Daisy Simmons is working to arrange passage from Calcutta to London. She will leave her family, her life, to be reunited with her lover, Peter Walsh. In 2017, Mina is trying to write a novel. She will restore agency and voice to Daisy, a woman who was never even given a voice in Virginia Woolf's seminal novel, Mrs. Dalloway. And as Mina works to free Daisy from her fictional invisibility, she must also reconcile herself to the bonds of career, of family, the duties that they place on her to make peace with the responsibility of a writer bringing life onto the page. I feel like we've barely scratched the surface with that, Michelle, but can I begin? On your website, you describe your work speaks to how racism divides the fabric of kinship, separating us from home and erasing us from history and from archives. And of the threads that I wanted to explore in Daisy and Wolf, I thought this could be a good place to start. And I wondered, did Daisy Simmons draw you into her orbit, or is she merely one of the many narratives that are given short shrift in the, what I might kind of call in scare quotes, the canon of English literature?
I think she is one of many characters who are minoritized and put on the periphery of white narratives, which are mainstream and which you know, perpetuate this domination of the white fantasy of existence and culture and superiority. However, of course, Daisy was particularly, once I realised that Daisy was Anglo-Indian, that she was Eurasian, I was immediately drawn to her because I felt that I had not noticed that in my earlier readings of Mrs. Dalloway when I was younger. And I think that's partly because of the way that Woolf writes in such a layered kind of way and such a sort of a pointillistic way, in a way where she's moving the perspective from one character to another, and it's actually sometimes difficult to follow what's actually happening. One's almost kind of getting carried and bounced along the language itself. And so I missed Daisy, and I missed realising that Peter Walsh was also Anglo-Indian. And that was really interesting when I came across that. And I was at the time doing a doctorate of creative writing. I was looking for a project. Mm. I had been kind of for many years trying to find that narrative about how does one speak about mixed ancestry, because I myself am mixed ancestry, and how does that story get told within powerful nationalisms which are competing, such as Indian nationalism, Australian nationalism? How does that mixed ancestry emerge, and also under the umbrella of Commonwealth literature or what have you, and how does England, where I spent some of my childhood, how does that fit into the picture? And it was, for a long time I've been trying to kind of to find ways of speaking this, and it's not easy because of many reasons why it's not easy. So once I found that Daisy, it was almost like this is the character, this is what I've been kind of waiting to find, and here's my project, here's my task, my creative task. I've also done a lot of work on metafiction and on, I would say you would describe them as paratexts, how other forms of textual writing can overwrite and fictions, and how that phenomenon creates canons, and how that creates spaces that dominate and creates people who are on the margins. The paratexts are things which can come about through publishing. Paratexts can also be diaries, such as Woolf's diaries or such as Mina's diaries in the book. The paratexts are types of writing. It could be social media, for example. They could be Instagram stories, or they could be tweets. Paratexts are kind of the other ways in which narratives can be told and stories can be told from the official version. And so this kind of bringing together of the paratexts and the main story is a way that you can you can resist the dominance of the white, ethnically pure narrative, which predominates within the Western canon. And I think within Asian canons, there are equally also ethnically pure stories. As in any country, it's very difficult to speak about those minority people, and the more minoritized they are, the less they are visible in history, in archives, in research, in law. Law itself is a sort of a story. So this is what's fascinating, and you have things like citizenship coming into law, and I think that's kind of touched upon a little bit in Daisy's search for, you know, when she approaches and tries to get a passport and has to leave Calcutta, and those kinds of things are sort of touched upon in a fictional way. Mm. So
I think one thing that I took from some of the examples there that you gave, especially exemplifying paratexts, very much speaks to the idea that the view of the world you take really depends on where you direct your attention, particularly, I guess, in this modern age when you mentioned things like social media existing as a paratext. And we know that, you know, there's more media out there. There are more of these stories than any one person can truly fathom. So you can create your own existence by paying attention in a certain direction. And it was very different, I guess. Well, social media was not around for Virginia Woolf, although there were various types of media. But before we get very much into how you do this. I wanted to ask a little bit about that relationship. What does it mean to be in conversation with another work, and specifically here in conversation with Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway? What does it mean to you, sorry, maybe rather than the larger, what does it mean universally?
Yes. I think there's, on one level, I think as a writer, you're also a reader. You read so many works that inspire you. And, of course, Woolf has been one of the inspirational authors for me because I love the way she uses language in such a powerful way to challenge the patriarchy and also to challenge the official kind of register and the law and things like that, and even empire as well. She does that in terms of her tone, and so I've always admired that. So I guess, you know, that when you it's a bit like you're in a fandom, you know, you really admire this writer, and so you become, as a reader, you become drawn to their works and involved in their works, and it becomes almost part of your own consciousness in a way. And in some ways, I think in terms of our imagination, our imaginations are shared to some extent. And I think that we all read books from the past, and what actually structures the way that we think about storytelling comes from what we've read in the past, and also our own stories. But there's that connection and that thread that continues and is ongoing, and I think in some ways it's like kind of collective history in a way, our collective imagination and this repository of stories that we can share. So I think for me, writing in this kind of way is a sharing. It's a collaborative project where you're not just in isolation. You're not just the sole source of the sole origin of something, but you're actually in a dialogue, in a conversation, and to some extent it allows you to engage in an argument about things that might be important, such as an argument about cultural domination, colonialism, power, gender, and so on. And so I think that's kind of what I wanted. I got to a point where of realizing in writing the story that in many ways I was walking with Woolf, and I was seeing myself ultimately as an equal. You know, I didn't have to say, I didn't have to be shy about it anymore and say, oh no, you know, she's the historian of Western feminism, and how can I kind of try to challenge that story, or it didn't have to be combative in that way. It was more, let's have a discussion about these things, and let's, you know, let's have a sharing, and let's tease out these ideas. And I found that there were also a lot of points in common that I had with her, threads, things about her story and my story. And I guess although she has an extremely different style to mine, style of writing, I think I came to see myself, if I can say, as an equal. And that was empowering for me. As a brown woman, that was very empowering, as a brown woman who's read a lot of Woolf and who's attended courses, and, you know, you look up to particular authors. So I guess that's what it means to be in conversation in this way, in this kind of metafiction, as it's called, or.
It strikes me in what you're saying there is a difficult juxtaposition in this idea of the shared experience of literature that we look back to, that maybe builds a reverence, builds an authority as a canon, in precisely what you were just talking about, that if you can imagine yourself into it, then there is enormous possibility. But of course, if you can't imagine yourself into it, if you're absent from it, then maybe it can be quite limiting. Is there something of that in Daisy and Wolf, that Daisy as a marginal character in Mrs. Dalloway, in bringing her to the fore, you are expanding possibility?
I hope so. I hope I'm expanding that possibility. And I was also aware that, for example, I'll just speak a bit more about that. I'm expanding possibility in the sense of having an Anglo-Indian character is a powerful thing, and I'm so excited that I've read a review that talks about that today in the Herald, and that was so exciting for me because only 4% of Australian Indians are Anglo-Indians, and yet it's interesting, a lot of those, there's actually quite a few Anglo-Indian authors in Australia. So I'm thinking of people like Christopher Raj and Bemla Hunt and some other writers. So I feel like, you know, allowing the reader to see what is Daisy's home like, what are her family like, what does she eat, what clothes does she wear, how does she think, that in itself is a major, if I can say, for me, it felt like a major achievement to bring that into the story, and even more so to have her as part of the title and to have her photograph on the cover of the book so that you see an Indian woman, a dark-skinned woman who isn't wearing a sari but is dressed in Western clothing and has a 1920s hairstyle, a more Western hairstyle, a European hairstyle. And that challenges the dominance of some types of construction of Indian nationalism as well. So that I think that is exciting that people, readers and publishers have been open to it and seen a space that needs to be open for this. And that's, I think that's very promising for me.
I'd like to address a question that I think many readers or potential readers will have, if not at the front of their consciousness, maybe just kind of niggling in the back. Now, I began Daisy and Wolf with some sense of Virginia Woolf. You know, I'd studied her at uni. I knew about her impact on modernism. I read and probably didn't understand To the Lighthouse. But I hadn't read Mrs. Dalloway. And as I read, I got to page 23 where we first encounter Daisy in her letter to Peter. And I got a little bit worried, and so I dug out my copy of Mrs. Dalloway and I started reading. And straight away, I grew concerned for Daisy because now I knew, I heard Clarissa, so I heard Clarissa Dalloway, Mrs. Dalloway, describe Peter as a dry correspondent. And I immediately thought, what is poor Daisy? Daisy is hanging on this man and he is apparently just a terrible letter writer. And I knew something else about the story you were telling that wasn't, you know, directly in front of me on the page. And it started to expand your world as well as the world of Daisy, the world you were creating. And what I want to ask you, and you don't have to answer, but was I right in doing this? Or would you prefer your readers to have read Mrs. Dalloway, or it doesn't matter?
that's a nice story. I like that you did that. And I wasn't aware that Peter was a dry correspondent. Mm. There's so much language in Mrs. Dalloway, right? So I think that perhaps my Peter is different. There were things that I wanted to also highlight that Virginia Woolf in some ways negatively stereotypes Peter Walsh as an Anglo-Indian. So part of what I'm doing is, like, I noticed in the language of the way that she describes both Daisy and Peter, it's kind of reductive, you know. He seemed to be a man who's preoccupied with his penknife, and he's like got these obsessive kind of traits about him, and he's bothersome, and he's over-emotional and so forth. And she presents this picture of him, and also Daisy is presented in a way where she's described as vain, and she's described as, in some ways, the suggestion is that she is a little morally loose, a little bit of a flirtatious sort of woman. And when you actually look at the way that Anglo-Indian and Eurasian people were depicted in 19th century novels and also earlier novels and stories and all different types of, journalism and so forth, they were often very negatively stereotyped with those kinds of qualities, where they were seen as sometimes as intellectually retarded or disabled in that way, or that they might have been seen as promiscuous and so forth. And this was a very, very common narrative stereotype. And I think that Virginia Woolf, perhaps it was a conscious thing, perhaps it wasn't, but she's kind of relying on those stereotypes. So I wanted my Peter to be a little bit different in some ways. And I think that it's great if readers can read both books at the same time, or if they choose to just dive into my novel and just not be concerned about what Virginia Woolf's novel, what that looks like, what the picture it gives is. Or if they choose to do what you did, which is to cross-reference, I think that's just fine. And I think it's exciting for me to hear that.
Like, I can recommend my edition. This is great radio we're making right now, because I am going to show Michelle my edition, which has kind of got a lovely, strange, I could almost see Phoebe Waller-Bridge playing this as Clarissa Dalloway.
Really gorgeous.
But this Grafton edition.
Beautiful.
The page numbers just do not correspond. So that made it a bit trickier.
I think I was relying on my original copy as well. I had two copies, one of which was falling apart.
that is incredible, just to see that intertextuality play through. It also struck me there's a really interesting power dynamic that is at play in my reading of Peter and your reading of Peter, because of course in imagining Peter you are able to flesh him out more, whereas say a reader of Mrs. Dalloway is getting they're getting Clarissa's views and understandings, and Peter does put himself at a disadvantage a strange disadvantage in terms of their power dynamic. He confesses his love. He reiterates his love. He allows Clarissa to feel this sort of superiority over him. And perhaps that colours her view, which again, very much reframes both the gendered power and also the power across, racial stereotypes that they might have of each other. That was something that had just occurred to me. The way Peter centres his loves really does put him in a unique position, I guess, both for the time and for our reading of him.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I hadn't considered that, but I hadn't considered that he makes himself so vulnerable in that way, and that's a really interesting perspective of probably a male perspective as a reader that I can see now that you mention it. I think it's interesting as well that Peter, when he discusses India and describes India in Mrs. Dalloway, it's quite derogatory, and that every time I read anything, I'm thinking as a reader, now is this Peter or is this Virginia Woolf? Who's speaking here, and why so derogatory? For example, when he talks about when he pursues the woman in the streets of London, he pursues a woman. He's describing how it's wonderful to see women after the not so attractive women in India. He says something like that. I think I recall. But also other things that quite derogatory things that he says about India. It's quite, you know, he alludes to a common sort of complaint that the ruling class would have had. You know, this sense of this picture of India as being disorganized, unruly, you know, which is kind of feeding into common fears at the time about kind of rebellion in the colonies and, you know, the independence movement rising and all of the fears of losing, you know, this important colony that you know, Britain had. And I think one of the main things about Mrs. Dalloway for me is although it, you know, it seems intimate in a way, this intimate story about this one day in a woman's life, and so much is left out of that time, mind you, by the critics and by Woolf. It's almost as if to make it really interesting, India has to be there. Mm. You know, to make Britain the power that it was, it needed these colonies, this richness, this exotic beauty and charm and interest and intrigue, and this wealth that it was also exploiting. This is what the empire was built on. Mm. And it's interesting how it's on the periphery, but it's almost an essential part of the story. So I wanted to make it central. I wanted to really kind of have this argument with, well, how does Woolf not just see Daisy and Peter, but what about India? What's going on for Woolf there?
I'd like to keep going, looking at this this perception and the way that, I guess, the way that Mina. So we've given short shrift to Mina at the moment, but she is discovering and searching for this story of Daisy. And as she searches the text of Mrs. Dalloway, and she also searches the world of Mrs. Dalloway, she travels, she searches the world of Virginia Woolf. She travels around the world looking into this story. It struck me she was hampered or was always coming up against a kind of coded, whether it's racism or an indifference in the text to non-white characters. Here's Mina kind of trying to interpret descriptions of Lucrezia, who is an Italian character. I won't go too far into the backstory here, but other than to say Mina's seeing her in Mrs. Dalloway as foreign and dark in that casual way that the upper class allude to difference. Now, she could be easily talking about Daisy here as well. At one point in Daisy and Wolf, Peter describes Daisy as a rare bird. There's this othering. It's kind of, I guess some people, some of the characters might describe it as not unflattering, but it is certainly othering and marginalizing. I wondered, in the writing, in her searching, is Mina seeking to restore these characters to the narrative, to give them more voice, more agency? Or is she also seeking a kind of justice for these women?
That's such a hard question, Andrew. and I'm not sure that it is for me to answer that question, because I think I'm, as the author, I'm not sure that I can speak to what the intentions of a character are, if that makes sense. But I can observe about it, and I think that I think it's so imbricated, her own experience of racism and of kind of walking through the corridors of empire, and always kind of, it's always being as a brown woman doubly colonized by gender and race, and also as an immigrant. So that also is another transition that she has to navigate, which is bumpy. All of these things can be thrown into her face, can be doors that are closing on her important points or moments when she's navigating the journey of her life or the direction that the path that she's trying to create, which is this story and this the pursuit of this story. So she, in many ways, they're part of the story. And I think perhaps for Mina, it's hard to say how much of these aspects are part of the story and how much she's kind of becoming the story, how much she's becoming what she's trying to pursue, you know, what she's, is she, you know, she's not Daisy, but she's not Virginia Woolf. She's not Daisy, but these are, these, it's it, the three of them are kind of, and the four of them, there's also Lucrezia, as you say, Rezia. So these characters are kind of moving in and out of each other in a way, but especially I think probably Mina and Daisy and Wolf. There's a movement. She's moving in and out of these characters' worlds, and it's starting to impact on her life. And I think maybe this happens, you know, with because creative energy is so powerful. It's kind of, there are many levels of it, and she's in a very precarious state. You know, there's a sense of family pressures and financial pressures and fatigue and also sexual assault when she's in London. And so she's quite precarious, and her life is unraveling. And I think that also heightens the creative energy around her when you have all those other pressures, as well as the pressure to create. It's quite a powerful thing.
It was incredible to travel alongside, and I really want to choose my descriptor carefully there, because there are some absolutely harrowing moments of Mina's journey. So I don't want to be too excited about the idea that I'm simply a spectator in all this, but to watch her consider her process and each moment that she goes through, to almost put that through the lens of her writing and ask herself, how can she speak to this, or can she speak authentically to this, or is this something that she can ever know to put into Daisy's voice, and then to consider how then she might realize Daisy's voice. Are letters enough? How will she speak? What, in what person will she speak? Just as a book guy, that's amazing. And that's incredible that you've put this in to Daisy and Wolf in such an engaging way as we travel alongside Mina and then Daisy in alternating moments. Take that as a comment rather than a question, but I just didn't want to let the moment pass that you took us so much into that process and brought it alive.
Thanks. Thank you. I'm glad that it came alive and it comes alive. It's some interesting how that falls into place. It's not always, I feel like the writing is not always intentional, you know. There are many things that layer the writing and, you know, one's research, reading, shifts in perspective as one does the structural edits and works with editors in the publishing process, and all of those kinds of things kind of come to bear on how that story intensifies and becomes complex, I think.
I think, though, in bringing this process forward, you really engage in a lot of topics that I think as readers we are and should be considering. One of the things, so Mina is exploring how she is going to bring Daisy's story to the page. She is traveling the world in search of parts of this story to understand it. And at a certain point, she has to consider, where is Daisy going? How is this story unfolding? And she says, a writer has to die a certain death for what kind of person dwells in infinite possibility. I mean, look, I would absolutely say there are probably whole chat rooms on the internet where people are dwelling in infinite possibility of their favorite characters. But of course, for a book to exist, in our hand, we need the writer to die a certain death for them to make that choice and say that this is the choice that will move the story forward here. I wondered how you had confronted this challenge. Like, what can you tell us about that process?
I can say that it sometimes feels like there are many deaths, you know, that, you know, firstly, I suppose from the point of view of the exhaustion of the writing process, it's physically exhausting. It's physically painful. One can suffer from headaches like Virginia Woolf did, or you can have, I often experience neck pain or leg pain. I write when I'm standing a lot. So I find if I've been working for many hours, my legs go to jelly and they're just sore, and it can actually be sore to walk. So the physical pain, and then just there's often, you know, there's the pain of postponement. You're postponing so many things in your life, and sometimes that's just exercise as well. And that in itself is painful, and so you often feel this overwhelming exhaustion. And I can remember quite a few times just so tired and thinking, oh, well, that's it, I've done it now. And then it wasn't to be. And that to me, it felt like a death, and then it wasn't to be. There was there was more structural editing and more to sort of to look at and finesse, and I had amazing support from the editors. On death, you know, how does one make those choices? And I think I'll answer you by saying, I'll speak honestly, and I'll say that often for me, the pleasure of writing is the point that comes when you're not as in you're not so much in the engine room. You know, you're not. It's almost as if the writing takes over. Mm. It's almost as if you take that risk. You trust the process. But in order to trust that process, you've spent many years upskilling. Often false starts, getting things wrong, you know, making a lot of mistakes. But you've spent years, so you know it's almost like you're doing your musical scales. You know, you've been practicing. So when it's time to actually sort of let the narrative take over, that's what you do. You let the narrative take over, and your role is reduced in a way. And to me, that's the greatest joy of writing, those times. It doesn't happen all the time, because there's a lot of scaffolding that goes into the structure of a novel, and then you take the scaffolding away, so that's also work as well. There were times in the writing of the novel when I was not as actively involved, and the writing was just writing itself. Mm-hmm. And that's the part about writing I love the most, because there's a truth about that. It's some unshakable truth. I trust it, and I hope I've developed the skills for a long time to, I've invested, you know, in my writing, as opposed to the career of it or anything like that. And I think that's what I think I love about writing. It isn't part of an industry, you know, as such, and yet it is work, but it's its own. I think of it more as like a profession in a way, something that you love doing, so you do it and you focus on it, and you find out what your skills are and enhance your skills and work out what your weaknesses are, and you work on those weaknesses. So in a way, you're teaching yourself as you go, and trusting, obviously, there's a lot of trust involved. In some ways, I would say, I'm not sure if I'm being too honest here, but being too revelatory, whatever, but in some ways I would say that I've trusted my creative imagination and that part of my life. Mm. More than I've trusted other parts of my life.
Cool. You sound so much more at peace with this process than Mina is. And I want to just dig a little deeper in that sense that you have the peace that I've heard you just describe there that Mina perhaps doesn't, and Mina in turn grapples with the way she is telling Daisy's story, because we live in a world where there is so much cross-identification between artists and their art. And it really grabbed me at one point. Mina speaks of herself. She confesses. She says, and I'm not going to talk about who she is referring to here because we're going to keep the story pure. She says, psychically speaking, I am her assassin. And that quote destroyed me. I thought it is incredible to think of an artist seeing this very visceral process of happening to one of their characters. I was on a social media site the other day, I can't remember which, but I saw a fantasy writer describe themselves as a serial killer in relation to presumably some readers are going to be pretty unhappy with this person's next book. And there was, so there's this real identification between the artist and their art, that responsibility to the characters that they're creating. How should we view this responsibility? Should we be making this link too closely, or should we allow artists to do things to their creations that are perhaps horrible, perhaps things that they might not even agree with?
I'm in favour of artistic license and allowing writers to pursue the direction that they need to pursue. All creators, I think, need that kind of freedom to just experiment. It's so important. Perhaps that's why we love to create, is for that sense of experimentation in our lives that it extends and expands from the other ways that we live our lives, you know, where we are so straitjacketed into what our identity is, what we do, how we do things, even time itself. Time constrains us, and it's that sort of freedom that we have in the creative process that I think is something that shouldn't be taken away from us. And maybe it can't be taken away from us. Who knows? You know, it's a wonderful thing to be able to dream and to see where that takes one. Yes, I'm all for that.
Let's talk then about the flip of that license, that ability to travel, you know, vast expanses on the page. And I want to return to Mina's own story. We meet her. She's left her life in Australia to write this book. She's living in London. She's particularly bereft at the separation from her son. This parallels a similar arc in Daisy's story that I won't say too much about. But I was actually hoping you could talk then about these feelings that Mina is struggling with, feelings that I think also parallel the narrative in Mrs. Dalloway, that of the expectations that are placed on women, that they are going to be the ones who will sacrifice, that they are going to be the ones who will stand back so that men can stand forward, and the costs that they have to, I guess, pay for not conforming to these.
Absolutely. I think that the cost is enormous. And I think the vulnerability of particularly brown women, because it's, I think, anyone who pursues an artistic life, you are in this culture, in this particularly as we become so much more capitalism and neo-fascism that's happening politically in the world at the moment. We're in difficult times for sure, and I think that it's the artist's life is a precarious one, and if you're a woman, it's hard to take that path and to then answer to the demands of family, society, spouses, children, and I think it makes you incredibly vulnerable. And if you happen to be a brown woman, you know, different things can also turn against you. And it's very easy to be scapegoated. That's what can happen. And it's also the fact that society just has a misunderstanding about what the artist does, what the writer does, and why the writer is apparently wasting so much time in their life, or, you know, mulling over unproductive things, and everything is monetized. You know, writing can't readily be monetized. So it definitely makes a brown woman incredibly vulnerable, and there is a cost to pay for sure. I wanted to make some of the things we've been talking about real for people, because they are real. These are not just abstract ideas. I wanted to give people a glimpse into some of the very real pressures that happen and play out, and also to call out the publishing industry and the cultural industries that support that publishing industry, but also the institutions that teach literature, universities, the academy, and so forth, and also affiliated organisations, and also newspapers, critics. Because they have an enormous role to play. Criticism and literary criticism has an enormous role to play in how it receives particular works, books, and stories, and how what I wanted to make real is that, you know, that it might seem a simple thing to write a reductive review of someone's work. But perhaps critics should be accountable for these things, because these are actually having very real effects on writers, and not just writers, on their families, on their lives. I don't think we think about that enough. I think that the role of the critic is somehow kind of free of those kinds of considerations. Ethical considerations have not really been kind of the role of criticism has not been considered in terms of ethical considerations sufficiently. And I wanted the average reader to get some sense of that, and to I suppose in a way I wanted to show that from the insider's perspective, through the mind and the emotions and the words of Mina.
Still living in a sort of a post-Barthes world where, you know, the text is orbiting somewhere in the atmosphere and the author's all death over there, and we don't have to think about them. The text is all. I was really interested there. We were talking about ideas of trauma, and I was quite interested in the way trauma plays out. And there was a really interesting parallel between Mrs. Dalloway, between Mrs. Dalloway and Septimus, and his story, his trauma, and the way that plays out. And it becomes something of a focal point around which the other characters orbit. Lucrezia is sort of spends the novel orbiting him and his behaviors, but then even the scene where it's a 100-year-old novel, but I feel really strange about the idea that I might spoil it for anyone. the moment where Septimus's fate is discovered and Clarissa sort of is there is a sense that she is thinking, well, how could he allow this, or how could anyone allow this to overtake my party? He very much kind of, in her mind, pulls focus. And Mina's trauma, or various traumas, but one in particular that I'm thinking about in Daisy and Wolf, feels like Mina has this pressure to deal with it differently. She feels she has to internalize it. She doesn't want it to allow it to escape into a public world and take up too much space. Could you, were you conscious of the, I guess, that reflection on different roles. We've talked a lot about gender roles and roles that are played by women, and then intersections between whiteness and women of color, brown women. Were you, I guess, alive to that idea that Mina was very much, I guess, she was doing what she felt she had to do to survive. That was such a word soup. I'm sorry. This is the problem when I write a paragraph and then don't somehow put a question on the end of it.
So to talk about, like, the way that Mina's just so on the edge.
The way our stories become embodied. For Mina experiences this traumatic event, but she internalizes it. And it's not that means it goes away. The idea that it's not externalized either through actions or through words, when we internalize it, it's still a part of us, and it plays out in our bodies, in our behaviors, as opposed to, I drew the parallel with Septimus, who very much externalizes his trauma. And I don't want to be casting any judgment on Septimus, either on his trauma or what happens, but very much the way when trauma is embodied, the way it plays out and the way that can either pull focus or force someone within themselves.
Yeah, there is a lot of trauma in the book, in the novel, and I think there's, for example, I think you're right, Mina is pushing down her trauma, the death of her mother, the assault when she's assaulted, what's happening with her son, the loss of their relationship, the change in their relationship is a major trauma for her. And she's still kind of just pushing a lot of these things down because she sees and she prioritizes the responsibility of writing the novel. She prioritizes the cultural responsibility to excavate this part of this canonical work and, you know, to bring Daisy out of the book and bring her to life and flesh her out and embody her. In order to do that, it's when there is so little sort of in terms of there are the foundations for minority narratives don't exist. Minority narratives have to rise out of the ashes. Yeah, you know. In that sense, the only way is something has to sacrifice, and that's, I think Mina sees that's there's no choice. That that's what she has to do. She has to create this. She has to be, you would say, across so many things. You know, she has to be across the history and the research, and she has to be across the travel, so she can be in these places and experience them and get inside what would it be like for Daisy to make this journey. She has to travel, and then in doing so, there is the loss of that dislocation, and there is the postponement of time when she's not with her son, when she's not with her family, when she's not being a mother, and she's not being a daughter. And those are the kinds of the griefs that she carries with her, whereas Daisy's grief is the grief of the mother that's going through the loss and the separation from her children. It's a different, she doesn't have the responsibility to bring about a whole character and a whole universe in a way, which is what a novel does in a way. A novel brings us into a world, or it attempts to do that. It attempts to create a world, an inner world, an outer world. And I guess, I think maybe those two characters kind of bounce off each other, or there's some resonance there in the types of traumas that they experience. But there certainly is a lot of trauma And I wanted to also, I wanted the reader to consider, readers to consider, what is it like when you don't own your own story, you know, when your story is being told about you. And there are times when Daisy, you know, she mentions that she can't, if somebody asks her about her past, she doesn't feel like she can tell them what her past is because they'll always interpret it in a different way. Mm. So it's the power of interpretation, you know, when you are, when you are a minority or when what you're talking about is not something common in common experience. So it's not just about being a minority. It's about whether your experience is if you're talking about something unusual. Whenever that happens, people will make judgments about you. People will start to interpret your story so that, you know, the ability to tell a story is kind of overlaid by all of these things. It's like overlaid by history, complicated by history, by law, by cultural interpretation, cultural judgment, stereotypes. All of these things are kind of the obstacles, as well as things such as the industry, the publishing industry, the media, all of these other things, which are obvious kind of mediators of telling stories. But the more subtle mediators of telling stories are actually intimate mediators, the mediators within our personal lives, the way people judge us, the way they don't listen to us, mm. the way they just don't listen to us. I think there's a part where Daisy says, you know, if I try to tell my story, people actually already are telling the story for me. They won't. When she's in France, when she's traveling in France and she's experiencing grief about her journey, she has this contemplation where she recognizes that she's not unable to share that story with people because they're already judging her. So I think these are some of the things that I wanted, you know, to kind of, well, they came into the story. They found their way. You could say they found their way into the story.
It sounds, they are also, it strikes me, just incredible things that as readers it would serve us well to have in mind, because it can feel like, I feel like it can feel like at times in our world that people want to believe in this sense that we all stand on a level platform and we all have equal opportunity to participate and to talk. And it's usually the people that have the largest platform that want to tell everyone else, well, you're equal with me, without understanding these preconceptions, the colorings, the history, the fact that the platform isn't level.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It is wonderful to espouse the idea that all stories are equal, but it's incredibly naive to when we start to even take a casual glance at the lived experience of people trying to tell their own stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're so right about that with the platform, the bigger the platform. I think you see this, we see this in social media, don't we? Like it's like the size of the platform, the size of the message, are sort of become one and the same thing, where in actual fact it's not the case, you know. So what about those people who don't have that platform? And you know, it's also, there are many things which can't be spoken about, you know, and that these things are also like things like pushbacks. I think I referenced them a little. I maybe wanted readers to sort of get a sense of it. How agency is constructed. I think things have changed so much in literature, though. You know, I think there's so many positive things about the way that we discuss literature, such as even having this conversation, you know, the way that conversation is breaking down the authority of literature in a way, dialogues and podcasts and social media is very subversive. And I think there's so much potential there for us to kind of to decolonize, to
Let me ask you then, because I was about to move us on to talking about your Sydney Writers Festival appearance, but you have dragged me away from my absolute word soup of a non-question before and reminded me that there was one other idea that I wanted to tease at, because both in Daisy and Wolf and in Mrs. Dalloway, we see and hear the writers exchanging books and discussing books and contemporary writers. And there is, I guess, also a sense that that literature, as we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, creates something of the worldview. I wondered if you could talk, in your view at least, what role you see literature playing in constructing that colonial world, but also, as you just touched on, having a role in creating a decolonial or a post-colonial world.
Oh, enormous. It's almost, language is so powerful, and literature plays an enormous role. It was actually part of the machinery of colonialism, you know, the education system that of missionary schools in all of the colonies, and the types of novels that were often romanticising and nostalgic and about some empire. And this sort of moral mission of empire that justified colonial exploitation and financial exploitation of countries like India, all of this was enacted through education and through literature as well. So that's why it's so important for books to kind of address this, and it's important for writers. I think it's I think it can't be ignored. I mean, I wouldn't be saying what writers should do. That's far from my views to say that, because I think all writers have their own particular path to explore, and you know, that's the beauty of being a creator. But I just think that what you've just talked about is so important, that this is literature is in a very important part of cultural production that actually enables domination and it enables racism to take place. And I'm constantly reading Australian novels, for example, where there are racist elements which are sort of like subdued in a way and turned down, or they're kind of implied, or you know, that one sees these and you know, novels, all kinds, the way that the tone of language and the way that small reductions can be apparent in language. So I think that we can really be inducting attitudes towards people through stories we tell about them. And this brings up issues of appropriation and so forth. One of the biggest challenges for me was to think about how do I write Radhika's story in this novel. Mm. And I was really felt like I was really concerned about Radhika's, how was I to write that story, and how can I step into her shoes, and how is it? I realise it's almost impossible to not do a disservice in some way, if that makes sense, you know, when we're telling these stories. So
absolutely, and this is such a live, I guess, debate that we've now entered into in the conversation, where we need to acknowledge appropriation, but we also, you know, we need to write widely and read widely. We need to acknowledge racism, and we need to be able to, you know, we need to be able to stare it in the face in the art that we consume. But as you also say, it needs to be done, I guess, in a critical way. I don't think if we had an Australian literature that ignored the existence of racism, it would serve to address racism. But also it has to be done in a way that doesn't bolster it or tacitly approve of it. And it's, I mean, I'm not going to ask you to give me an answer. I don't know that anyone has one answer, but the act of engagement that you've talked about, that we're doing here, the act of engagement and not pretending that everything is fine, is probably a starting place.
I hope so. You know, I definitely, it is most definitely a starting place. And it's, I feel Daisy and Wolf is, it's a huge achievement, really. People say to me, oh, so what are you going to, I had a question that I have to write an answer for. What will you be doing next? And it's like, you know, I don't think people realize the obstacles. I feel like I was extremely fortunate to have Hachette take this story, because I think I had a really good agent in London, and it's not easy because there are so many industry barriers. Like, let's not forget as well the importance and the power of Bloomsbury itself. Mm. You know, it's so many books have been written about Virginia Woolf. And I just want to say, if I can, when I touch on that, that one of the things that struck me the most was that very few, if any, I didn't really read any criticism, any literary criticism that recognised that Daisy was a brown woman. The one long essay I read on India and Mrs. Dalloway described Daisy as an English woman. So that in itself speaks to the way that racism operates to blind us, you know, to kind of, even when we can see things, we can't see things. It's this kind of obfuscation of really, it's almost like a kind of a crime in a way of erasure.
I found, I just wanted to, as you were saying that, I wanted to let you know, and unfortunately I still had it open in my browser. I did in my research find a literary journal called Apt. It seems to be aforementioned productions.com. And there was a piece that was there, and it's very, very short, and it's written in a kind of a continuation of the story type style, and it's just entitled, I Like to Imagine Daisy from Mrs. Dalloway as an Indian Woman, and the author is S.J. Sindhu. And as I read that, I had this moment of, I don't know if this is something that is more widely recognized, or if, you know, I hadn't engaged enough with the text of Mrs. Dalloway to understand what other people's readings were. But sorry, when you mentioned that, I thought I'd just share that I'd found that in my research.
Oh, that's so interesting. I'd love to read that.
I'll send it through to you. I'll send it through afterwards. It's cool. It's really short. It's about six paragraphs. Of just, you know, sort of describing, an imagined element of the story. Sorry. Would you mind terribly, Michelle? I'm going to take not an about face, but sort of a segue us into just a quick question about Sydney Writers Festival and your appearance.
That would be awesome. Thank you, Andrew.
Here we go. I'm just going to bring my notes back up, get us in the right spot. I am speaking with Michelle Carl. We are discussing Daisy and Wolf, and Michelle is going to be joining the lineup at Sydney Writers Festival. It's just such an incredible lineup, Michelle, and really excited that on the 20th of May, you'll be in conversation joined by Yumna Kassab and Felicity Castagna. Just two incredible writers. Daisy and Wolf, as we have discussed, it blew me away. What are you looking forward to from this conversation?
Oh, it's just going to be really, really awesome to be at the Sydney Writers Festival and in conversation with Yumna and Felicity, two authors I so, so admire. And, it's going to be really awesome because Yumna's written a book about characters who are minoritized in the periphery and the margins also. And I just think it's going to, I'm looking forward to that one. So that's on May the 20th. At the Sydney Writers Festival at 2 p.m. And I hope that you guys can come along. If you're listening in, please come along. We'd love to see you there. And that's going to be awesome.
It strikes me it's going to be just such an incredible conversation that will touch on areas that you and I have been talking about. You're also doing a workshop, Restoried, writing historical fiction. And I mean, I feel like anyone who has that sort of feeling that there is a historical fiction story in them would be wanting to check that out. And for details about everything Michelle is going to be appearing at, you can go to swf.org.au. Michelle, I'm just going to give us a bit of an outro now.
Cool. Thank you so much, Andrew. It was so awesome to talk to you.
Oh, pleasure. Let me just record. I'll just do like a sort of a radio sort of... I am speaking with Michelle Carl. Her new novel, Daisy and Wolf, is an absolute sensation. It just blew my reader's brain away. I so rarely take so much pleasure engaging with just the act of reading. Michelle, it's been terrific. Thank you for indulging my questions, and thank you for helping us explore Daisy and Wolf.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today.
That's it for this great conversation with Michelle Carl. Michelle's new book is Daisy and Wolf. It's out now from Hachette. Thank you so much to Michelle for being so generous with her time. Michelle is part of the Sydney Writers Festival lineup. If you are getting along to the festival, or more importantly, if you can't, you can discover many incredible Sydney Writers Festival writers in the Great Conversations podcast. Just search through the podcast in whatever podcast app you're listening to, or, you know, look us up online. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Stay in touch. Let me know what you're going to at the festival, how you're enjoying the books that we discuss. You'll find Final Draft. You can talk to me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. If you subscribe in your podcast app, it means a new Great Conversation every week, often more, including the Tuesday Book Club, including special bonus episodes. My name is Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. Thanks for joining me, and happy reading.